Hello and welcome to 251, and we're back to our original idea of two pianists, five podcasts, one subject, although with a slight variation. My name's Simon Whiteside.
And my name's Nick Tomlin. So this episode is going to be the first of a series of five about the arranger stroke pianist Marty Paich. And this episode we're going to do today is going to focus on Marty Paich, the pianist. But Simon's going to look in a bit more detail at Marty Paich, the arranger, in the next four episodes, and is going to speak to some other arrangers in the business about him. But yeah, today we're going to look at Marty Paich, the piano player. And I'm going to hand over to Simon, who's going to give us a potted biography of Marty Paich.
Marty Paich was born in 1925. During his varied career, he was a pianist, composer, arranger, record producer, music director, orchestrator, and conductor. As a pianist and arranger, his impressive list of credits led him to work with jazz musicians such as Peggy Lee, Ella Fitzgerald, Stan Kenton, Art Pepper, Buddy Rich, Ray Brown, Shorty Rogers, Pete Ruggolo, Ray Charles, and Mel Torme, coming to prominence with Mel Torme and the Marty Paich Dectet. Later in his illustrious career, he worked extensively in film and TV music. Here is a synopsis of his musical working life. In the 1930s, when he was only 10 years old, Marty Paich was already leading bands and performing at weddings as a native of Oakland, California. When he was 16, he wrote arrangements with Pete Ruggolo. He served in the U.S. Air Corps during World War II, after which he attended the University of Southern California and later received a master's degree in composition from the Los Angeles Conservatory of Music. His teachers included Julia Balda Zuniga, Mario Castelnuovo Tedesco, and the serialist music pioneer Arnold Schoenberg. In the 1950s, in addition to working as music director for Peggy Lee, he wrote arrangements for Chet Baker, Ray Brown, Stan Kenton, Shelley Mann, Dave Pell, Buddy Rich, Shorty Rogers, and the movie The Lady and the Tramp. He began recording with Mal Torme in 1955, on the album It's a Blue World, when Torme was moving from crooner to jazz singer. During the next year, 1956, his 10-piece band accompanied Torme on the album Mal Torme and the Marty Paich Dectet, which contained the celebrated version of the 1930s song Lulu's Back in Town. It was with this ensemble they went on to make several successful albums, my personal favourite being Mal Torme Swing Schubert Alley. Another long association was with Art Pepper, the album Art Pepper Plus 11, Modern Jazz Classics, perhaps being the most well-known, with a similar lineup to the famed Dectet. In the 1960s, he spent less time as a pianist and more as an arranger for pop singers such as Sammy Davis Jr. One side of the Wham of Sam is with the Dectet. He also worked with Dean Martin, Barbara Streisand and Andy Williams, Dinah Shore and Jack Jones. At this point, he was scoring films such as Hey There, It's Yogi Bear, The Man Called Flintstone, The Swinger, and Changes. In the 1970s, he worked as an arranger in film and television, winning an Emmy Award for the television drama Ironside. He led the studio orchestra for television variety programs such as the Glen Campbell Good Time Hour and the Smother Brothers Comedy Hour, and was replacement for Nelson Riddle on the Sonny and Cher Comedy Hour. He orchestrated and conducted scores for the films The Fugitive, Pretty Woman, and Prince of Tides. I first noticed his name as orchestrator and conductor on James Newton Howard's score for the original Flatliners movie, which was not long before Paich died of colon cancer at the age of 70 in 1995. Dave Paich, a founding member of the rock band Toto, is his son. In this series of podcasts, I will discuss Paich as pianist with my long-term collaborator, Nick Tomlin, and his arranging style with fellow arrangers.
So today we're going to really look in detail at two main recordings by Marty Paich. One is the only trio album he recorded, which was called The Marty Paich Trio, 1957, and we're also going to look at a quartet album he recorded with Art Pepper from 1962. But Simon, I think you want to just talk more generally about his career as a pianist.
Yeah, I mean, he started his first gigs were when he was very young, 10, 11, 12, that sort of period when he was still a schoolboy. But he started out as an accordion player.
Hmm.
And there is an album with the multifaceted Bob Enervoldsen, whose name is very hard to say, who he's one of these multi-instrumentalists who turns up on the West Coast a lot, who primarily was a valve trombonist, but also played really pretty good tenor sax and all sorts of weird brass instruments. He plays really well on that album, and why that is interesting to me is, well, I mean, maybe we will talk together about that, is that he plays a bit of accordion as well, and it, and it's actually rather tasteful in a jazz context. But really, as a pianist, he had a 10-year career as a pianist, more or less, pretty much the 50s, and he retired from playing, he gave up playing piano as a... Well, apart from a very late resurgence when Mel Torme had a dectet, kind of comeback in the 80s, but he didn't really play piano again after the 1960s. He sort of announced his retirement almost. But his in the early 50s, I mean, he did play with some touring bands in the early 50s, not what we would call name bands, but his first proper really good albums are with Shorty Rogers, probably in 53 and 54. And in fact, the first one is called Cool and Crazy, and it is a really significant West Coast milestone. It sort of sets the decade up as the whole thing that, you know, it has a French horn and a tuba in it, for example. And Marty Paich was the pianist on that. And in his obituary from The Independent, it's pointed out that his piano playing is actually quite significantly important to that album, and then even more important to Shorty Rogers' Courts the Count, which is a tribute to Count Basie. And actually, Marty Paich really does suit that sparse, delicate interjection style of Basie piano very well. Those two albums, 53 and 54, sort of started him out on the road to being a much better known player. And then there's a list of things where he's... These are kind of him as pianist stroke leader, really. There are other albums that, like that one I mentioned, where he's a sideman. But as a sort of leader, he had an album with Russ Garcia called Jazz Music for the Birds and the Hepcats, which I haven't been able to find any audio for, but it sounds quite interesting. It's got a good band, Conti Condoli, Bob Enervoldsen again. There's a tenor player who I've never heard of called Bob Hardaway. Marty Paich on piano. Tony Rizzi on guitar, who would join him in the Dave Pell octet at some points. Max Bennett on bass, who's quite well known. And Stan Levy, who we've talked about in that heavyweight biography of his, autobiography. Then in this same year, he did Tempo da Silva, which is a Jimmy Guthrie kind of thing, really. Again, it's a sort of medium-sized big band. Then, very successful for Marty Paich. And Marty's always on piano in these albums, I should just point out, so we don't just keep having to say it. Tenors West is quite a big album, which essentially is... it's a kind of duo front line with Marty Paich's octet behind. So that's... Jimmy Guthrie and and Harry Klee, who's quite well known on the West Coast. Conti Condoli and Bob Enervoldsen again. Jack Dulong, who I don't know if you've come across, but he turns up on a lot of West Coast albums as a baritone sax player. And again, a good rhythm section with Joe Mondragon and Frank Capp on drums. And then... the Art Pepper album we're going to talk about. There's another thing which was sort of released as a West Coast sort of all-stars type album, which has a really weird long title, which I won't go into, but very similar people, more trumpets, more big bandy, that one. Then the album Marty Paich Hot Piano, which is a weird one, because that's another... that's an album with piano, Howard Roberts on guitar, Joe Mondragon on bass, and Larry Bunker on drums and occasionally on vibes. And that was later released as Jazz for Relaxation, which has a very salacious naked woman on the front.
There's quite a few albums around that time.
There was a meme. A lot of Marty Paich's albums seem to have women in showers and things, or chorus girls with their legs up on the in the changing room. Anyway. One of Marty's probably best albums as a leader was Paich, the Picasso of the Big Band Jazz, which was a quote from somebody, I think Archie Shepp or someone like that. And that album's fantastic, actually, if you haven't heard it.
Yeah, no, I haven't. I should definitely listen to that, yeah.
That's a real... His albums with that smallish big band thing are brilliant.
Mm.
Then he did the trio album we're going to talk about. He also did an album called At a Jazz Band Ball, which is, again, a small-ish band, Don Fagerquist and Jack Sheldon trumpet, the often-present Bob Ennevoldsen, whose name I will eventually get right, Stu Williamson as well, on Marty Paich on piano, Buddy Clark on bass, who I fell into the difficult... When he played with Sonny Clark... Got confusing which Clark we were talking about.
Yeah.
Mal Lewis on drums. Mal Lewis and Shelley Mann were quite big sort of partners for the whole of the West Coast people.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting one. Then there's an octet that was fronted. It was really Marty Paich's band, but it was fronted by the trumpet, really nice trumpet player called Don Fagerquist, who is one of those sort of unsung heroes of the trumpet, really. He was a fantastic player, but just didn't really want to be famous, happy earning a living. Beautiful tone, lovely solos, and that's called Music to Fill a Void, which is has got a great cover, line art cover. Then there's the Modern Touch of Marty Paich, which is also called the Broadway Bit. And then the second part of that is called I Get a Boot Out of You.
Oh, yeah. I think that's got another salacious...
That's the shower
cover.
One.
That's the
I
shower
think.
One, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
There's some amazing arrangements on there of particularly like moaning. A lot. He was starting to get... this. You can see where Art Pepper Plus 11 comes from. Then we start getting into the slightly weird... multiple piano albums, Marty Paich and his Jazz Piano Quartet, which had also had the first one had Jack Sheldon on trumpet, Victor Halban on vibes, and the four pianists were Pete Jolly, Marty Paich, Jimmy Rolls, and Johnny Williams. And it's that, yes, it is that John Williams who wrote Star Wars. Al Hendrickson guitar, Joe Mondragon bass, Shelley Mann drums, and we kind of move. There's a second one of those albums. I won't list its entire output, but it kind of leads up to, I guess, really, the last thing he records is probably the... well, there's a few things that he recorded with... there's a crescendo club live set with Mal Torme, for example, in that period. But he doesn't really play again until a brilliantly named album in 1966, and that's maybe later actually, called the Jazz Rock Incident, which is
sounds painful.
Yeah, I think that maybe it was 66, but after that he didn't really play again until, as I mentioned, the Marty Paich Dectet. They did a tour, Mal Torme, and they got a lot of the old band together who were still around, and they toured Japan very successfully and released some albums called things like Reunion and stuff like that. And they were all the old charts, really. What's interesting to me is modern recording methods really, I don't think, that there's a vibe about the early charts, I guess because they were new and exciting and it was a big thing, but... You know, then the guys are a lot older, and it's 30 years later, and they're playing the stuff in the 80s, and it, it, it just didn't sound as good.
No,
I mean, the players were, in theory, are older and wiser, but just the production of those albums is just kind of didn't work in the modern. I think a lot was lost in jazz recording through the 70s and 80s. And basically, people didn't record a lot of jazz, so
they didn't have the knowledge.
So some of those early albums were recorded by the recently deceased Al Schmidt, who was a real one of the kind of big names in Los Angeles film and recording studio. A bit of a legend. His book's very interesting about how to record, in terms of how to record jazz and how they did record jazz in those days. So we're going to take a short little interlude here, and then we'll come back and talk a bit about those albums that we mentioned, the Art Pepper Quartet and the Trio album.
Okay, so the first album we're going to look at in a bit more detail is the Marty Paich Trio from 1957, recorded for Mode Records. And it featured, obviously, Marty Paich on piano, Red Mitchell on bass, and Mel Lewis on drums. And it sort of featured a mixture of originals by Marty Paich, a few standards, and also a tune by Jack Montrose, who... he was another West... remind me what he played, Jack Montrose. He was a...
I always get confused whether he was a pianist as well or a sax player. Mm. There are a few arrangers around that time.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, he plays one of his tunes as well on this. So the tunes on this album, I Hadn't Anyone Till You, which is a standard. And then there's three originals by Marty Paich. One... I quite like the title to this one, The Facts About Max. I'm not sure quite who's talking about Max Roach, or I guess there were quite a few Maxes around.
There were.
Dusk Light, which is another original. A tune called The New Soft Shoe, which I think was one of his kind of better-known compositions. In fact, he recorded it with a bigger band, I think, later, maybe even a couple of times, I think.
Yeah, I think that's one of his perennials.
Yeah. And then this Jack Montrose tune called A Dandy Line. And then El Dorado Blues, another original by Marty Paich. And then the standard What's New. And then a tune which was a new one to me called By the River San Marie, which I think actually it was a Harry Warren tune, I think. I'm not sure where that came from.
The Dave Powell Octet recorded that one as well. I think that was actually a John Williams chart for the Dave Powell Octet.
Okay, well, that's interesting. Yeah, so it's quite a good mixture of standards and originals and I mean, it's the first time I'd really listened to him as a piano player. I mean, I was obviously aware of some of his recordings, the Art Pepper Plus 11.
He doesn't play piano on that.
But I sort of know him more, I guess, as an arranger. So it's the first time I'd really listened to him as a piano player. But I mean, I was quite impressed, really. I think he, you know, it's very. It's, I mean, this album. I think he plays slightly differently on this album to, for example, on the Art Pepper album. And on this album, I sort of thought of it more in the kind of. I've put kind of Duke Ellington, Ahmed Jamal, sort of Count Basie school, really, which if that's a school, I don't know, but it's kind of, it's quite sparse, not very linear. I mean, he plays lines and he's got a really good sort of, obviously good grasp of bebop, but he's playing more texturally, I think, and more kind of like an arranger in a way that he's obviously thinking of textures and you know, he uses the different registers of the piano and I thought it was. I enjoyed it. I thought it was. You know, nice playing.
It's the type of album. If it was on, if you were in a coffee shop and it was on in the background, it wouldn't trouble you.
No,
I mean, you wouldn't think, oh Jesus, what's this?
It's a good
solid album, if you like.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah,
and I think that's what is interesting about Marty Paich. He was a he really was a pianist. He just was up against Russ Freeman and a whole bunch of really top-notch people.
Yeah. But you sort of wonder if he'd have really concentrated on that, you know, whether he could. I mean, he probably could have, made it as a pianist. But obviously, he was more interested in the arranging side of things.
Well, certainly that period where he studied with post-war, I think I'm pretty sure it was the GI Bill type thing, where he studied with Mario Castelnuovo Tedesco. And in fact even had a summer camp thing where he studied with Arnold Schoenberg. He didn't really play then. He wrote pieces for string quartet and, you know, some symphonic music and various very much concert hall stuff. And he's no slouch. He graduated magna cum laude, so, you know, what we would call a double first. Or something. So it was a big deal, really. And he did extremely well as a serious, for want of a better word, composer. I always think of this Mario Castelnuovo Tedesco, if I'm saying his name right, as a sort of Nadia Boulanger of the West Coast. He had a hand in many people's, many well-known people's education. I think even including John Williams, if I'm right. But certainly he was a big force, unknown really by people, but I think Gil Evans also might have gone to him. Jerry Mulligan might have had lessons with him. They might not have all studied a traditional course, but
he's kind of like a guru sort of.
Someone who, I think the reason I quite deliberately called him the Nadia Boulanger of the West Coast was that she was very good at helping people find what they did.
Yes, that's true, yeah.
So when Astor Piazzolla went to study composition with her, he came along with sort of string quartets and concert pieces, and she said, they're not bad, but that's not you. You're a Argentinian bandonian player. You should be writing music. You should be writing the best Argentinian bandonia music that you can, and take the tango somewhere new. And that's what he did very successfully.
Yeah.
So I think he was very good at saying to people, you should be a film composer, or you should be...
Sort of bringing out their strengths, really, I guess, or recognising their strengths.
Yeah, recognising their a good path for them. So I agree with you. I think he plays well... I think that New Soft Shoe is a good tune, and I'd certainly have heard it played possibly multiple different formats. I wouldn't like to say for sure how many different formats I've heard it in, but I'm pretty sure it could be on his octet his own octet album, and it could be on, he might have done it for the Dave Powell octet, I can't remember now. But yeah, it is a good tune. Have you got any other thoughts about generally about his sort of style of piano playing?
I mean, not particularly. I mean, I think he's obviously sort of coming from bebop, but at the same time, I feel, you know, he, as I said before, really, he's more interested in, he seems quite interested in sort of chordal textures. You know, he uses a lot of that sort of language as much as the kind of linear stuff. Although he does, as I said, I think he plays slightly differently on the, well, we're going to obviously talk about the Art Pepper one, but he plays a little bit more kind of bebop straight ahead, I found, on the on the Art Pepper recording, probably just because it's a different setting, really.
I mean, I think also his game is raised by playing with Art Pepper. I mean, he kept Art Pepper alive, really. He was very important to his career, and has had him on all sorts of recordings that stopped Art Pepper killing himself. Really.
Right, okay.
You know, Art Pepper plus 11 is probably Paich's best known album, I would say, for general jazz fans.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the Marty Paich deck stuff with Mal Torme is obviously very, very important as well. But that plus 11 thing is a great album. that a lot of people know, and maybe don't even know really that it's Marty Paich because Art Pepper's name's on it.
Yeah, sure. Yeah,
but
yeah.
He was a big advocate for Art Pepper,
mm.
and really looks after him. Mm. If I'm honest,
mm.
I mean, in terms of what I think about his playing, he can be a little bit tongue-tied. I think sometimes his phrases can be quite short.
Mm.
There are a couple of Paichisms that he's got this thing that he does quite a bit on. If he plays a little bit of piano on both on some of the Maltorme things,
mm.
there's one called arrangement of Lonely Town,
mm-hmm.
and he does this sort of slight. It's almost like a I don't know how to describe it actually. Really, it's a sort of a falling figure thing. Bling bling. Bling, bling, bling.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Almost like a sort of Ellington type thing, almost reminiscent of something like In a Sentimental Mood. Sorts of things. He does it on Angel Eyes as well. On can't remember which version of Angel Eyes I'm thinking of, but that's very much one of his things. Mm. I don't really hear anyone else do.
Mm.
Mm. There may be other people who do it a bit, but he seemed to do it a lot. But then occasionally he'll unwind this really nice long beboppy line.
Yeah, yeah.
But he does, I'd say he plays quite diatonically as well, in the sense that he's playing that scale. He's not, there's not a lot of side slipping really in his playing. And also the other thing I would say is what's your opinion on his sort of quaver feel?
Yeah, well, it's very straight. He's playing, his quavers are very straight. I mean, you know, when we talk about quaver feel, obviously, it's, you know, there's many variations, aren't there, of the basic quaver feel. Some players kind of play them more triplety, you know, but his quavers are quite straight, but they still swing. I think it's because of the way he uses the accents, you know. So in a little bit like, I mean, some of the bebop players, I mean, even Parker, you know, if you listen to Parker, his quavers are quite straight. He doesn't really swing his quavers, you know, especially on the slightly more up-tempo tunes, but it's the way he's accenting the quavers that make it swing, and I feel it's the same. You get the same sort of effect with Marty Paich, I feel.
Yeah, I mean, it's for those who know about, who use electronic music-making devices, what we call digital audio workstations, basically you might get, the majority of jazz pianists will play at 8C quantization for swing. Marty Paich is definitely around the A and B level, which is where the quavers, so just to reiterate, I think we have probably spoken about this on one of our 5-minute podcasts, all of which, of course, you can reference on Buzzsprout, but or your any podcast provider that you use. But the idea is that classical quavers are equally divided, and you get 8 of them in a 4-bar, in a 4-beat bar, which is why Americans call them eighth notes. And they are totally equal, and a classical player will, if they see that written like that, will read them as totally equal. Mm-hmm. But a jazz player, as we know, will read them as the second quaver is further away from the first quaver, and it's about how far away it is.
Exactly, yeah.
And I would say that I agree with you that Marty Paich's piano style is not that far away from equal.
Mm.
Whereas there are some players who are almost a semi-quaver away.
Yeah, yes.
And other players who are, like you say, pretty much a triplet.
Kind of, yeah, there's like a...
And there's shades, you know, and it moves as well, doesn't it?
Yes, yeah.
So
exactly. It's like a continuum, really, sort of.
Some of the very rhythmically strong pianists, like a Brad Meldo, will move that distance within a line, even.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can use it to create an effect, you know, so
and go straighter.
Yeah, you can play more straight or swing. It's and in a way that's what gives an individual player their sound, part of it. I mean, on the piano you're kind of a bit limited in respect of, you know, tonally, I guess, but definitely like I can very often tell a piano player, like I can tell Wynton Kelly just by the way he swings his quavers. You know, it's like
how far he lays back.
Yeah, and how far he lays back on it. And so that's like a, it's like a signature in some ways, you know.
Yeah, definitely. But, and the other thing we should say, was slightly going into our 2:51, 2:5 version here, but we should also say that the speed at which the song goes affects the straightness
of
the quavers. Yeah. So faster songs, even people who swing very late, will be playing a lot straighter if they're playing at a fast tempo.
Yeah, because it's just because there's less there's less time, there's less space between the quavers, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess. Absolutely. So,
but it's also interesting that it shows that it's, you know, when I teach this, you know, I very often kind of I sort of put the emphasis on accents because I feel the accents create the sense of swing as much as the actual the feel of the quavers, you know.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, if you listen to Marty Paich, the way he's accenting those quavers.
So really would you like to tease that out for our listener?
So I think it's, well, the simplest way of saying it is that it's accenting the second quaver, the off quaver. So you know, do dud 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 dud. So you're kind of making the second quaver slightly stronger, but it's not actually as simple as that, because if you listen to someone like Parker, his accents are, you know, he's
moving.
His accents are moving. They're changing all the while. You know, if you actually look at a phrase of his accents are and sometimes very kind of he's not accenting where you'd expect the accents to fall, you know, which is part of what creates this sense of excitement in his playing, really, you know, but also this sense of swing in the playing. But it's one of those very, very difficult areas that it's really, really hard to talk about and sort of pin down, isn't it, really?
It is quite hard to talk about, but I thought it would be interesting for people to hear that laid out, because to say it's about where he accents, I guess, doesn't.
Yeah, no, it tends to be on the. It tends to be the off. So you're accenting the second and fourth quaver rather than the first and the third.
Yeah,
generally,
comes out actually. That translates to his arranging. So you'll often hear a phrase that's voiced by, you know, the dectet or something, which goes da 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 do ya do ya.
So
he's really
accenting the off.
Yeah,
the off
really
beats.
Getting that off.
Yeah,
that syncopation sort of sound. And it's really sometimes it's quite hard to get people to play that, in modern players to play that. Which is an interesting, you know, people to talk about how. I mean, jazz feel has gone straighter, I think.
I think that's true.
Modern players.
Yeah, and probably because, well, again, it's a bit of a generalization, but the kind of. I mean, talking about Coltrane and post-Coltrane, those players, like Coltrane had quite a straight quaver feel as well, you know. And I think a lot of players that came after him kind of copied that in a way, you know. But it varies. It varies a lot, even between players, doesn't it? You know.
It does. You're right. Mm. And I think also we should talk about. We should move on to the other album. Do you want to sort of set it off, or let's have a short break and then we'll come in with that?
Okay. So the next album we're going to look at in a bit more detail is an album which was probably recorded in the mid-50s, but was released in 1962. And I think originally it was called the Marty Paich Quartet featuring Art Pepper, but it was also released, sometimes it comes under the name of Chili Pepper as well. I think it was kind of had a few different reissues. And the personnel for this album was Art Pepper, alto sax; Buddy Clark, bass; Frank Capp, drums; and Marty Paich, piano. And again, it's a sort of mixture of standards and originals. So they do What's Right for You, which is a standard; You, the Night and the Music, fairly well-known standard. Then there's a track called The Sidewinder, which immediately makes you think of the famous Lee Morgan track, but this isn't that. It's actually by Paich and a guitar. We figured out who's a guitarist called Bill Pittman. They wrote that together, Paich and Pittman. There's a tune called Abstract Art by Marty Paich, obviously referring to Art Pepper. Then a couple of standards, Over the Rainbow, All the Things You Are. Then it ends with sort of three originals, a tune called Pitfall by the same guitarist, this Bill Pittman. Melancholy Madeline by Robert Sherman, who was one of the producers, I think, or the producer of the session.
He supervised and he wrote the liner notes.
Yeah. And then finishes off with Marty's Blues, which is obviously a blues by Marty Page, needless to say.
I can confirm it was recorded in 56.
Okay.
And it was recorded by Val Valentin, who's a really good... recorded a lot of really good jazz albums.
Mm.
I remember the first time I came across him, it might have been a Marty Page recording. I think he's one of those people who got really great sound for jazz records, but isn't really that well known.
Mm.
But anyway, I couldn't find out a lot about him, I think he was at Hollywood Recorders or somewhere like that. So worked for Verve, did a lot of Verve recordings and MGM records.
Mm-hmm.
But he is particularly well known for his jazz recording, but then did later on work for people like the Velvet Underground and other, you know, when rock kind of took over. But he was one of those people who was in the background. It's not like a Rudy Van Gelder who you can read a book about, sort of thing.
He's sort of under
the radar.
Yeah.
Anyway, so what are your thoughts on this? Oh, just to let people know that I transcribed the one chorus that Marty solos on for All the Things You Are, which will be available to look at as a PDF.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it. I think it's a really, really solid album. I really like his comping. I think I don't know if it's a feature of arranger pianists, but think of Count Basie, think of Duke Ellington. They were always really interesting compers. You know, I don't know if it's, you know, I mean, we could maybe think about that as well. Whether it's because they're thinking
like
more
arranging.
Like arrangers, yeah, basically. Yeah. They're thinking, so it's not just. You know, you do get some kind of piano comping, which is just sort of a bit aimless kind of, but it never sounds aimless. What he's doing, he's always setting up what the soloist is doing and he's always kind of...
It's like there's a concept behind...
Yeah.
I agree. I think it's because he spent a long time as an accompanist also for singers.
Yeah, sure.
So he was Peggy Lee's accompanist.
Yeah, yeah.
But he also toured with Dorothy Dandridge.
Okay.
Who is the voice of Hollywood, really. She was the person who replaced the voice of actresses a lot.
Oh, okay.
In Hollywood.
Okay.
But she was also had her own career. And in fact, I think he came to London. Marty Page came to London with her in the 50s.
Okay.
On tour.
Hmm.
But yeah, so I think he's a very experienced accompanist. And in fact, he just like many arrangers, he's more comfortable not as the feature.
I think
it seems to be a feature of arrangers. And the other thing I find about arrangers is that, you know, with a lot of them ended up working in Hollywood. So he obviously, we mentioned that he won an Emmy for his Ironside scores.
Mm.
And Nelson Riddle wrote, you know, famously wrote Batman, didn't he? And Oliver Nelson, I think, was the $6 Million Man. A lot of these arrangers were very much sought after, or found a niche in Hollywood.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they could work quick.
Yeah.
Because they were used to producing an album's worth of arrangements in a few days. And that's what TV, particularly TV, required, especially if it was live.
Yeah.
And Marty Page was also a musical director on multiple TV shows like The Smother Brothers, which was a big hit show. I agree with you. He does support people really well.
Mm. I think also, I mean, just thinking about it, really, I mean, I suppose if you're accompanying a big band, you know, you have to be really aware of, or I mean, that's why those players that I mentioned, Basie and Ellington, they both developed this kind of, it's kind of a sparse style, but also when they play, it's very considered, if you know what I mean. It really kind of adds to the overall effect. I can't, it's hard to explain, but you know, so I think what I'm trying to say is that because because there isn't that much opportunity very often for piano, is there, in big band? You know,
no.
There'll be like little features, but you have to really think about how you're going to fit with the band. And I think probably that carries over to his comping in a quartet, where you're thinking about, you know, what's needed, really, I guess. Do you know what I mean? Rather than you're listening to the soloist and thinking, what does this need, really?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
No, I agree. He does have that quality of... Well, I think the best thing I can say is, which is what I've already basically said, is that it's a concept. That he'll approach something as, right, I'm going to do this for a chorus.
Yeah,
you know, he's almost like thinking, right, I'm thinking trombone comping.
Exactly, yeah, yes, yeah.
I'm thinking sax solo.
Those sorts of things. Yeah, he's thinking of the texture behind, and I suppose as an arranger, you're thinking about how can you create these different textures, you know, and how can you create these different sections, and, you know, so he's obviously thinking more in that way than just sort of plonking down chords, kind of, you know, which can happen sometimes with piano comping.
It is an interesting observation. I mean, I think he plays the solo on All the Things You Are is quite interesting. One of the reasons I chose that one was because I've transcribed Sonny Clark on the same tune from the Serge Charloff album, Blue Serge. But and I think I've also transcribed Wynton Kelly on it and various people. It's one of those tunes that I like to transcribe different people on,
yeah,
so to get
what they're doing.
Comparisons. And in fact, interestingly, I saw on Instagram today that Peter Martin put out a solo piano version of All the Things You Are.
Okay.
And that's, you know, very, again, another very different modern approach to it. But yeah, it's a good showcase, and I think he really liked Art Pepper. He really cared about Art Pepper. And it's you can kind of feel that too. It's very supportive.
Sort of connection between them. Yeah.
And I think he raised his game a bit for that.
Yeah,
playing with him.
I mean, his playing is, as I said, it's kind of slightly different. It's more, it's a bit more beboppy, a bit more linear, isn't it? He's playing longer lines, and it's not such. I guess, you know, I mean, I suppose when you're playing with a trio, it's a slightly different concept sometimes to if you're playing in a quartet or quintet or something, you know, and you can kind of hear that, can't you?
Yeah. Yes, it's a funny combination, isn't it? It's this change from medium-sized band to big band to octet to... I mean, Marty Paich was definitely, in terms of an arranger, very much part of the West Coast contrapuntal thing, but that's not how you play when you play with Art Pepper.
No, sure, no.
So
no. You have to adapt to the situation.
Exactly. Yeah, so in a way, it's an atypical kind of... He's not in his comfort zone, perhaps. And it's different than a singer, because a singer will do what they do. And, you know, you'll be colla voce, it'll be a bit more sort of lounge piano-y. Whereas I mean, let's face it, Art Pepper is one of the great saxes. So he's up there with, I suppose in a way, he's making the most jazzy jazz album that he's going to make, in that sense. You know, in the kind of Charlie Parker sense, or that the Blue Note album, massive kind of people. Had a quintets, quartets, and never really played arrangements, I suppose. It's a bit more. I mean, there are arranged parts. You mentioned the end of that Melancholy Madeline track. Is it Melancholy Madeline? Got that right. Yeah. There are some arrangey things in there, but
it's more of a straight ahead kind of
jazz
session, really, isn't it? It's just
And one of the reasons I chose that was the fact that it is very piano-y in that sense. I mean, even with Mal Torme, when he, it's worth listening to that crescendo, Live from the Crescendo. Mal Torme is really quite funny as well. It's a proper act that he puts on. and there are quite a few musical jokes in there as well.
I have to listen to that. Yeah, I mean, to be honest, you know, actually just doing this and listening to some of these has kind of inspired me to listen to more of his stuff. Because, again, I sort of know the, you know, like the well-known.
Well, it's album. Funny, isn't it? I mean, I've said this to you on multiple occasions about Sonny Clark, for example, is that I didn't realise how much Marty Paich I knew until I started getting into him.
Sure.
And it's like, oh, I really like that. Oh, yeah, that's a Marty Paich.
Yeah.
Oh, I really like that. Oh, it's Marty Paich.
Yeah.
I mean, even my favourite Sammy Davis Jr., which is the Wham of Sam, I didn't really, really think, I mean, you know, from listening to it way back.
Yeah.
I was listening to, you always first off listen to the music, don't you?
Yeah.
And you're not necessarily a liner note monkey. I mean, have you got any wrapping up thoughts that you'd... I think we should probably have a short break after we've talked about this album and just do a little wrap-up on what we think of him and as a pianist and the like. But also, we probably ought to mention the Totally Mad Quartet albums with Johnny Williams, etc. Any further thoughts on this before we...
On this particular album?
Yeah.
No, but I really enjoyed it, and I was kind of quite pleasantly... Well, I don't know, I'd say pleasantly surprised, but I think it was... Because I've never really heard him in this context, really, as a sideman on a pretty much straight-blowing jazz album, really, isn't it? You know, but he really kind of, you know, holds his own, definitely. And as I was saying to you, I mean, you sort of wonder if he'd have really focused on...
If
he'd just done that,
you know, probably would have had a career.
He probably would have had a career.
Well,
yeah,
for I mean, sure. 10 years isn't bad, is it?
No. So it was just it's interesting to hear him in that context.
And there are plenty of albums that he's on that we haven't mentioned that where he's playing as a pianist for other people. I mean, I mentioned some of them in that.
Yeah,
you know, the Tenors West is Tenors West. I highly recommend if people don't know that album. It's a really good album, and Marty Paich plays well on that. I think for me, probably the piano playing that I think he does most successfully is that on the Courts, the Count, Shorty Rogers album.
Mm-hmm.
And you can hear how the two of him and Shorty Rogers really did kick off that classic, what we think of as West Coast style.
Mm-hmm.
And you can hear that in his in the playing too, in that sort of, like you say, the Count Basie sort of... figurations, light touch, sparse thing.
Yeah, which is really, really hard to do. I mean, I think that's the thing with, you know, with that style. It's I think some people sort of listen to Count Basie and think, oh, well, you know, he's just playing the odd little figure here, which he is, but it's, you know, it's how you do
playing,
it and what
he's
not playing and the space he leaves and the feel, you know, it's you know,
it's hugely distilled, isn't it? And it's like a fine. I said to someone actually, this was about poetry, but there's a difference between simple and simplicity.
Yeah, absolutely.
In a
sense,
it's not just facile or dull. It, the best player, I mean, Miles Davis is another good example of that. Someone who distills the real essence.
Well, I mean, Count Basie began as a stride player, you know. I mean, he could play stride piano, but he just decided, well, it wasn't right for his band, you know. So he just sort of developed a style that fitted with what he needed to do, you know.
It's actually interesting that one of Marty Paich's early influences with the Jimmy Lunceford band.
Right, okay.
And you can hear some of that again in that. That's quite a Basie-like band, isn't it? Well, let's wrap this up, and then we'll have a short break of tiny interlude here, and then we'll come back and do the full wrap-up. So here we are wrapping up on Marty Paich as pianist, the end of the first of five podcasts that will come out. Not exactly sure what their frequency will be, but... As pianist, my general feelings, this is what I think about him, is that he was a very good piano player, and as you've pointed out, probably could have been just a piano player if that's really what he wanted to do. But that wasn't his interest, really. And you can kind of hear it in his piano playing, in the sense that he's obviously, sometimes he'll play an inspired line, but that's the kind of line that Kenny Drew or Sonny Clark would...
players' bread and butter, and then they'd have an inspired line on top of that level.
Yeah, yeah.
And that fluency, he doesn't seem fluent to me somehow. He often has these kind of short phrases which suggest, like, I've got an idea here, and it's not really going anywhere. I'll start again.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure if that was... I mean, it's hard to know if that was a technical fault or if that was a sort of a choice. Because, I mean, Ahmed Jamal is kind of the same. You know, he doesn't really play linear. He'll play these little phrases, but they're very disconnected. But I think with him, that was a choice. You know, he deliberately...
Yeah, I get it. I'm not saying I'm not saying it was because he didn't have ideas. I'm just saying that he wasn't a flowing piano player.
No, sure, for sure.
That's all, really.
Yeah, yeah.
And I do think that a lot of people will be quite surprised at how good he was as a piano player. Mm. And I would strongly recommend listening to... I mean, if you can find that Bob Enervson quintet album, it's really interesting. He plays some really nice stuff on there, Marty Page, but he also plays a bit of accordion. Mm. And it's also sometimes quite arranged, which is in a real... It kind of, if you can listen to one album with Marty Page on it that sums in his entire life as a musician, well, without the film music, of course, but it's that whole thing of being kind of thinking about music as an arrangement, whatever he's playing, whether it's, oh, I think we have the colour of the accordion for this one, or whether it's thinking, I'll play some block chords.
Yeah, sure.
Know, or it's
sure.
Always counterpoint, you know.
Yeah.
And it's only an EP, that Bob Enervson quintet thing.
I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, it is interesting. It is interesting. And I think I'd just like to say one little bit about the mad idea of the piano quartet.
What's mad about four pianos?
What's wrong with four pianos? Well, for a start, getting four pianos in the same studio is in itself a feat.
Yeah.
It was not his idea. I'm pretty sure it was a guy called Dick Pierce who came up with that idea. And the first album that he did was about... It was based on a theatre show. I'm trying to find it in my list here. It was by a Bob Merrill. It was all tunes by Bob Merrill, and it was a bit like doing. It was a bit like doing a what's the word? A concept album. Mm. I can't find it now. Maybe it's not in this list.
So they're all tunes from the same show.
Yeah, I'm trying. Right. I've gone and shot myself in the foot here because I can't remember what it was that he played on. But yes, it was a show that Bob Merrill wrote all the tunes for, and he did it in the same year. So it was 1959, I think, the first one, and he did it in the same year of the show. So it was something that was very much in the public domain at the time. And of course, you know, a bit later he wrote that Lush Latin and Cool album, which has got a totally bonkers version of the Sabre Dance by Cataturin on it. Which is crazy. I mean, it's worth listening to for just so that you've listened to it. But the interesting thing was that Dick Pierce, I think it was Dick Pierce, who said to him, Marty Page was saying, I'm struggling with the idea of how I'm going to make four pianos work together. And he said, don't think about it as four pianos, think about it as one pianist with eight hands. And that kind of cleared up the concept for him.
Yeah, yeah.
And it does work. It actually does work, surprisingly.
Yeah, yeah.
It does work. And there is not just four pianos. It's obviously with the rhythm section and guitar and vibes and sometimes other trumpet and things like that in there.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's really interesting stuff. And also that testament to the fact that in the 1950s there were quite a lot of weird albums, like, you know, modern percussion sounds, the modern sound of percussion. They'd just be, you know, sort of concept albums for strokey beard hipsters. I mean, even Frank Sinatra did one called Colors or something, where he conducted a big band playing these sort of arrangements.
Oh, right.
I'm not sure if he did any of them, but I can't remember what it's called now, but there's a Frank Sinatra concept album conducted by Frank Sinatra.
Wow.
Anyway, any other thoughts to finish off?
No, I think we've kind of covered it really, but it was an enjoyable, it was really enjoyable to check him out really as a piano player.
Well, I thought you fitted well into our concept of the under-the-radar pianist that we've done in our five-minute podcast.
And
thanks for kicking off this series with me. And I thought it was fitting to sort of make the gentle transition into guests on the podcast.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing the next four.
Thanks a lot for doing it. And so from me, Simon Whiteside, goodbye.
And from me, Nick Tomlin, goodbye.